Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We open up the week here with something that we feature every month on the show, and that's home maintenance. Scott Spies is the guest. He's home inspector with the Spies Home Inspection Service, and he has been stopping by here on a regular basis for a while now, every month on a Monday, to talk about things that go on around the home. If you have some kind of problem and you're not quite sure how to fix it, you can call and get some advice. Maybe you're thinking of making some changes, thinking about doing some remodeling, any and all of that. Scott knows a lot about the various pieces and parts of the single family home. Could be you're thinking about adding insulation, or you have some furnace issues, or could be anything else that has to do with siding or gutters or roofing or basements or, you know, what have you. All you have to do is pick up the telephone and give us a call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, so that means if it would be a long-distance call, you may use the toll-free line and we'll pay for the call, and that's 800-222-9455, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. You start any point here. In fact, the lines are already starting to fill up. We will get some callers on here just as soon as we can, and we'll take as many as we can and go right through the hour. Well, thanks very much for being here again.
Good morning, David, here. Playing in all the snow all week, all day yesterday. Kind of nice to get into the studio for a while.
Well, we got somebody to start with in St. Joe, and we'll do that right here. Line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Hi.
My question has to do about adding insulation to ductwork in the attic. In our attic, there's a foil-backed Manville Thermlock ductboard. It's about 1 inch thick, I estimate. And that's where the warm and cool air blow into the registers. And then I have flux ducts about 1 inch thick for the return air. So I just wondered if that insulation is adequate.
In extremely cold weather, the attic temperatures do drop quite a bit, so a little bit more insulation would help distribute the warm air more evenly. Now, you're indicating that we've got our supply ducts in the attic. Generally speaking, most supply ducts are down on the floor, but if you've got both your supply and your return up in the attic, then yes, it wouldn't be a bad idea. They make some 4-foot-wide fiberglass insulation blankets, so you could basically just roll over the top of it and just kind of lap over it and help keep those ducts just a little bit warmer so you have less heat loss in that attic area.
Okay. And would you recommend on all around the duct or just on top?
Well, most of your heat loss is up. By putting one of these blankets over the top of it, it does a pretty good job of keeping the heat in the duct. Yes, it should lap down over the edges or over the sides, but you don't need to make it airtight. Just get a good covering over the top of it. Like I said, it's a 3.5-inch bat, I think 4 foot wide with a unfaced, you don't really want a covering on it because we're not trying to use it as a vapor barrier.
Oh, okay. So if it's and you're recommending it go over both the heating and cooling duct and return air ducts?
Well, that would be the best way because with both of them, what ends up happening if you let your return air get too cold, then your furnace has to bring that back up to temperature, and so you end up blowing a little bit cooler air through the system. Whereas if the return air is already relatively warm, then the warm air, the air going through the furnace is coming up a certain temperature. Let's say it comes up from 60 to 140 or something like that, where you're getting that kind of a gain. Well, if the air coming back is 70, well, the air coming out is 150, so it actually feels a little bit warmer and gives you a little bit better heat.
Yeah, okay. And do you have a recommendation of what R value should be used?
Well, since you've already got the ductboard, which has got a fairly reasonable duct insulating value, I believe it's anywhere from a 4 to 7, depending on the product. You really don't need to go over it with 14 inches of insulation over the top of there because the air is moving through it, so it's not like it's sitting there. So anything from 3.5 to 6 inch should be fine.
3.5 to 6 inch. Is that like R13, R19, or something like that?
Yeah, I'm sorry. A 3.5-inch bat is generally considered to be an R11, whereas a 6-inch bat is considered to be an R19.
Okay, good. And now you talked about unfaced. I was thinking about the paper face on the bats and just securing it with tape so they'd be good and tight. But you don't think that's necessary?
Well, actually, that's the incorrect way of installing it. I see it on a day-to-day basis. The paper backing is actually supposed to be on the warm side of the insulation. So if you've got it someplace where you can tape it in place, that means you've got it upside down.
Oh, I see.
It can act as a vapor barrier. You don't want a vapor barrier on the cold side of any insulation. Otherwise, any warm air moving through the insulation will tend to condense on the vapor barrier, and it actually can form moisture inside the insulation, and wet insulation doesn't insulate.
Okay, good. Okay, good. And the last question is, what sort of safety equipment should I be using for this job? Like, do I need a mask or gloves? What's the deal on safety equipment?
Well, there's nothing up there that's going to be injurious to your skin other than the fiberglass can be a little itchy, little glass particles get in there. It's always a good idea when working in a high dust area to have some type of a mask over your face. You don't need to necessarily get into the big HEPA filters for something like that. It's not like we're using chemicals, but you've got dust and dirt up there, and it's always a good idea to put something on.
So just mask and maybe work gloves?
Work gloves are recommended only because the fiberglass can get a little itchy.
Yeah. Okay, great. Thanks, Scott.
All right. Thanks for the call. Other questions, certainly welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. It's our monthly show on home maintenance, and the guest is Scott Spies. Do you think that probably most people have leaky ducts and might benefit by, to the extent that you can get Adam to check for leaky spots and then do something about that?
Well, ductwork, as a general rule, does usually have some leaks in it. A lot of it depends on where the ductwork is located. If the ductwork is located in the crawl space and you've already got a reasonably well-insulated crawl space perimeter wall and band joist area, then a little bit of heat loss in the crawl space really isn't an issue because that warm air comes up and kind of warms the floors and keeps your feet warmer and gives you a better perception of the heating of the house. So I'm not as concerned. Now, if we have 3-inch holes in it, that's a different story. We need to block it up so we can better regulate the distribution of the heated air. In the attic area, usually the return air ducts are located up there. Most of the time, the return air ducts are fairly basic and simple, a long run of flex line or something. So there's not too many connections or breaks. So it depends on the duct situation you've got, where they're located, what kind of duct you've got, as to whether or not it pays off. But yeah, there is a lot more heat loss through the ductwork than a lot of people realize, particularly when I find the metal ducts in the crawl space. Quite often I'll go down into a crawl space and almost instantly realize, hey, this is air conditioned or heated down here. So we may have a duct loose or something that would help keep the heat and air-conditioned air back in the duct. Mm. That's one of the reasons why I really highly recommend insulating crawl space walls, perimeter walls, rather than floors, is because of the amount of heat loss from the ductwork.
Right. Next up, we'll talk with somebody in Lafayette. Line 4. Hello?
Hello.
Yes.
I think I know the answer to this one. The meaning of condensation on the inside surface of the storm window.
Okay. On the storm window or the prime window?
No, on the storm glass.
And the storm glass is outside of the prime window?
It is.
Okay.
The condensation is on the enclosed side.
Right. So it's trapped between the two windows.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Usually what that will mean is that the storm window is actually sealing tighter than your prime window, and some of your warm, humid house air is actually making it to that window.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is also a case that happens when we have a fairly damp, wet period just before we get into a freezing period, because then the air between the two happens to have some moisture and it isn't ventilated out quick enough, and so we do get some frost on there. So if it happens once, usually the first time or two in the fall, then I wouldn't worry too much about it. But if it's a regular occurrence, yeah, it usually means you need to do some weather stripping on your prime window.
Okay. Asphalt shingles, when's the worst time to walk on them? When they're cold and brittle or hot and gummy?
Well, ideally, you'd like to avoid both times. When they're really hot, you can damage them. When they're really cold, they are brittle. So you try and find the medium days in the fall and the spring is usually the time I like to recommend people getting up there. Obviously, the less foot traffic you can put on the asphalt shingles, the better.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I do try and avoid them on really hot days. And, of course, anytime it's freezing out, you got to be careful for frost and ice and things like that. But
sure.
I won't say there's a good time, but it's better if the temperatures are probably more moderate.
Okay. Finally, I've heard you shouldn't use duct tape on ducts and recommend it instead the metallic tape with a better adhesive.
That is correct. Duct tape works wonders on all sorts of things. I saw that book, 101 Uses for Duct Tape. Matter of fact, I was at the local farm supply store the other day, and they were selling duct tape wallets.
No.
Completely made out of duct tape, which is a really good use for duct tape, but taping ducts is not it. Basically, the adhesive is not a long-lasting adhesive. You put it on there, and it tends to deteriorate. So while it works well for a while, unless you want to get up there and redo all your duct work or duct tape every 2 to 3 years, it's usually not recommended.
Okay, then it's a strange and misleading name for it.
Well, originally it was used for sealing ducts, and then they determined that it's a good durable, it's a good strong tape. The adhesive used on it nowadays is just not enough to adhere for any long period of time, so it's not a long-term fix. It's a good temporary fix. The foil tapes have a much higher adhesion, and they tend to stay on for years and years and years. It's not uncommon I've found foil tape. Usually it's dated, so I use it as a kind of a cheat when I'm doing my home inspections to see how old the house is or when the furnace was installed by looking for the date code on the foil tape. And I found it 30 and 35 years old and still holding well.
That's long enough for most of us. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's come back here to the next caller, and that would be someone in Urbana, line 2. Hello.
Good morning. Yes. I have a question about a light fixture in my dining room.
Okay.
We installed it and quite carefully read the directions and got it all installed, finally. And it has 5 bulbs, and I put the new compact fluorescent bulbs in it. It's on a dimmer switch, and the dimmer is not working properly. The light gets a little bit lighter, and then there's a sound, like a buzzing sound, and then it gets duller again. And I wondered if there was something about the dimmer switch that I was not aware of.
Well, as a general rule, the compact fluorescent bulbs do not work well with dimmers. The dimmer switch is designed for an incandescent bulb and not for the fluorescent bulbs. So the energy-saving bulbs are not designed to be dimmed like that.
Is the caller still there?
Hello?
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. We had a little problem with one of the lines didn't want to hang up. Anyway, so did you hear Scott's response?
Yes, I did. I did, and I'm going to remove those energy-saving bulbs and try the incandescent and hope that does it for the...
Yeah, dimmers. I think you'll find if everything is properly wired, I think you'll find that will work fine. But it seems that the compact bulbs, because of the transformer that it requires to heat the gases in the fluorescent bulbs, it does not like to have the voltage dropped. They do make special dimmers for fluorescents, but the standard incandescent dimmer is not the one to use.
Okay, good. I will take care of that. And I have one other question about kitchen. I play my a Sony radio in my kitchen, and there's interference somewhere along the line, and I wondered how that can be identified and taken care of. That is, while the radio's on, there's also a humming that goes. And I've now plugged the radio into an outlet on the opposite wall, and it appears to be okay. But I was wondering if there's something that can be done to take care of that interference.
Well, it sounds to me like we're getting a little bit of RF, or radio frequency interference, usually multiple wires running alongside each other, or a high current draw item. Most of the time, you can go to the like local Radio Shack, and they'll have little RF filters that you could plug into the outlet and plug the radio into it. Most radios, most appliances do have some type of filtering system built into them. Sometimes the lower end or less expensive items don't have, and that sounds to me like that could be the case. And you might be able to fix it with a filter from Radio Shack.
I will try that. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
Bye.
We have as our guest this morning here on Focus 580, Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's with us every month, always on a Monday, to give you the opportunity to call in here and ask home maintenance questions. Got a problem? I know he'll do his best to help you out. So 333-9455 is the number to call here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. Again, just to go back to the dimmer issue, if you really do want to use compact fluorescence and you really do want to have a dimmer, you can, but it's got to be a dimmer that's made to work with compact fluorescence.
Yeah, I have seen dimmer switches for fluorescent lights, commonly used in large neon lights and things like that. So there are dimmer switches that are designed for it. It's something you do have to go to like your local electrical supply store and say, hey, here's what we've got. What can we do?
Okay. Next is caller in Mount Carmel, line one. Hello.
Yes, this is Chad, and I've got a question on a garage door. The cable on top of the garage door keeps coming off to one side, and I was wondering if you deal with that any time.
Okay, so it sounds to me like you've got an alignment problem somewhere. I'm assuming you're talking about the cable that goes all the way to the end of the garage door track and then wraps around the spool.
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. Usually if they're not wrapping correctly, there's an alignment issue somewhere or something getting in the way, if it's catching on one of the springs or something like that. That's one of those items where trial and error works pretty well, kind of sighting down it and seeing what's causing it to move off to the side. There's no easy fix for it, short of getting down there and figuring out exactly what's causing the cable to move over. I've seen it be as much of a problem as being a bent shaft, and I've seen it being just as simple as rerouting the line, the cable, an inch or two away from the spring so that it didn't rub against the spring, which caused it to wind onto the spool incorrectly.
Okay.
Yeah, it's one of those things, if you can't look at it and figure it out, I guess we need to call a garage door guy to come out and take a look at it. It's usually pretty straightforward mechanical stuff.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And we'll go to Champaign next. This is line number three. Hello.
Hi. I have a couple of questions.
Okay.
One, just listening to the other caller, a question about the fluorescent lighting. I have a timer, and it's on my front porch, so it's, the light bulb's up really high. And when I tried it with one of the low-energy thingies, during the day when it's supposed to be off, it tends to flicker off and on a little bit. So I've replaced it with an incandescent bulb. Is that supposed to happen?
The fluorescent bulbs that they're a nice energy efficient bulb, but they are right now they do not work well with dimmers or low level usage. I know a lot of outdoor lights are you have a low wattage or low usage until you get a motion in front of it or something, and then it comes up to a brighter illumination, and those do not work well with those fluorescent bulbs.
Okay, I guess I'll get a young spry person to put my light bulbs in for a while. Now, the other question I have is an ongoing discussion in my neighborhood. Do you want to have your furnace fan going all the time?
Well, yes and no. So that's going to be a lot of... I guess it depends on how well the house heats. I do not recommend turning the furnace fan to the on position when we are in cooling mode, because we don't want to move air past the cooling coil when the condensers or the compressors not running, because we don't want to re-evaporate any moisture. In heating mode, it can actually feel like a draft. I mean, it depends on how often the furnace is firing. If you've got an older house that's relatively drafty and the furnace has to run quite a bit, and you've got one or two cold rooms, yes, turning the fan to the on position can circulate the air through all the rooms so that they feel a little bit more comfortable, or at least from room to room, they're all about the same temperature. But the problem is when the furnace isn't running, it almost feels drafty. So from a perceived comfort standpoint, I don't recommend putting the fan to the on position. My particular house that I live in has a bi-level, an upstairs and a downstairs, but not necessarily a basement. And I've noticed that most of the time, my upstairs is just a few degrees warmer than downstairs, which is normal. Heat rises. And so when I have guests downstairs in the billiard room, we turn the fan to the on position to circulate the air throughout the house so that we pick up a little bit more heat downstairs. But I don't leave it that way all the time. It's one of those things where it all depends on the individual house. If you've got one or two rooms that are cold or too warm and we can't control them with duct dampers, then when you're going to use those areas, you might want to turn the fan on. But if it's something that you need to leave it on all the time to keep the house comfortable, it sounds to me like we need to do some redesigning or rethinking of the furnace system.
I win the prize. Thank you. It seems to me if you leave it on all the time, it's just like you're sitting in a draft.
It can feel a little drafty. And also, one more point, when you said you were going to find some young, spry person to put in your light bulb, when you buy light bulbs, instead of buying the low quality, stop in at one of the electric supply stores and pick up a couple of the slightly higher voltage bulbs, the 130-volt bulbs, more the industrial, and they have about 2 to 3 times the life. They're a little bit more expensive, but in hard-to-reach places like that, they last much longer.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Again, to another call here. This is Champagne, and this is line number 2. Hello.
Hi. I have a question about those guests, the logs you find for cleaning your chimney.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if they are any good at all, and if they are, how often do you have to use them, especially if you only use your fireplace 4 or 5 times a season?
My guess is if you're only using it 4 or 5 times a season, you really don't need to spend that much time cleaning it. Generally speaking, you clean a chimney about every 3 to 4 cords of wood, which is a lot of wood. What is it? A cord is like 4 foot high, 2 feet deep, and 8 feet long, I believe.
Something like that.
You go through several of those. I don't think if you're using it 4 or 5 times a season that you're actually creating enough problem. Again, it depends on what you're burning. If you're using a lot of pine, which has a fairly high sap content, can create a lot more creosote. If you're using a hardwood, which burns a little hotter, a little bit cleaner. Of course, gas has almost nothing that it puts as a residue in the fireplace. The fireplace cleaning devices usually burn a little bit hotter, so they try and burn some of it off. They also use a little bit of chemical to soften some of the creosote. I'm going to have to defer to the manufacturer's recommendation as to how often it should be done, just because there are different products on the market, and so there's no one blanket answer.
Mm-hmm. But those logs actually do have some benefit.
They do, more so in a masonry chimney than in a metal flue. If you've got a prefabricated metal fireplace, or not, you don't usually need.
No, I have a masonry.
You have a masonry flue. Like
I think it's maybe got a clay
tile liner. That would be normal.
Mm-hmm.
From the amount of usage you're indicating, I would say cleaning it once with a professional chimney sweep would be good for the next 10 to 15 years.
Okay.
Because you're just not using it a lot.
And basically the chimney sweeps who are here in town all are fairly valid. You just go with a friend's recommendation?
I would recommend that, yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks
Bye-bye.
For the call. I'm sure that people in that business would say if you're burning wood in your fireplace, even if you don't burn it very often, that periodically you should have it professionally cleaned and inspected. So I guess the question just is, so how long are you going to do that? Every 2 years? You're going to do that every 3 years? You're going to do it every 5 years?
Actually, I haven't run into too many of the chimney sweeps that say that. Basically, it's a usage item. If it sits there empty, it's not getting dirty.
Right.
And if you burn good warm fires, it stays relatively clean. If you burn short cool fires, especially a little bit of newspaper, some pine, things like that don't burn very hot, and you shut everything down after an hour or two where the chimney really doesn't get warm enough to heat the creosote out and help burn it off. So it does depend on individual usage, but it is a quantity. It's not something that the chimney is going to get dirty automatically by sitting for 2 years. Yes, it may get some spider webs in it. Occasionally, I've even seen some leaves and things like that in them from if there's not a good screen at the top of it. But that's not the type of stuff the chimney sweep is getting out. He's usually trying to scrape the creosote and the combustion buildup.
Yeah. So it's a matter of what your burning habits are. Are you burning good, well-seasoned wood? How often are you having fires? And obviously, if you're not using it at all, you really don't need to have anything done.
Correct.
Okay. Our guest here this morning is Scott Spies. You got a call. I got a question about home maintenance issues. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Our next caller is in Atwood, and this is line 4. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. Back to the curlicue light bulbs.
Uh huh.
If you read the fine print, which apparently none of your other callers have done, you're not even supposed to use them in enclosed light fixtures. Why is that? I read the fine print on the not on the box, but on the bulb itself.
On the bulb itself, it says no enclosed fixtures?
Not put on it. Do not use it in totally enclosed fixtures.
Well, I will have to admit I haven't read the instructions on the bulb. I'll have to see if I can't find that out.
The box doesn't say it, but the bulb does. Now then, back for contamination. They're full. They got mercury in them. Isn't that worse than what the regular bulbs have? Are we really gaining anything with the mercury in a fluorescent bulb?
Well, it's a very low percentage of mercury in there, and if you're breaking the bulbs, and that's
they're going to get broken sometime when you dispose of them.
Yeah.
Do you follow my line of thought?
Well, I'll be honest. I think a lot of the energy-saving stuff is costs us more in energy in other places. I'm not sure that the media completely is truthful about how much energy we save on a lot of devices. Mm-hmm. And every once in a while you find them backtracking, saying we shouldn't use things. So you never know what might be discovered by tomorrow. You're absolutely correct. If there are hazardous chemicals in there, we don't necessarily want to have them in the landfills, which means it costs more to get rid of them, which means they're really not saving as much energy.
Well, you read the fine print on the bulb itself. Then sometime or other, you can mention it on the next month.
All right. Well, thank you for bringing that up. I'll see what I can find out for you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. I think, though, certainly what the caller says is true, is the recommendation is that when you're finished with your compact fluorescents, you shouldn't just toss them in the trash with everything else. They are supposed to be recycled in a particular way. Now, I think also there are some retailers that are making an effort to take the bulbs back so that you don't just put them in the trash. But depending upon where you live, that may indeed be an issue.
Yeah. It's amazing how many of these newfangled items that are saving us so much energy do present future problems. We run into that in the building industry also often. We can't get good products here, so we switch to another product, and that product, we use it for a few years, and all of a sudden we realize, hey, this is being caused by something completely different. So it's kind of an interesting world we live in, how fast things are changing.
All right, let's go to Paris for another caller here, line number 1. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Merry Christmas.
Oh, thank you.
I just heard a presentation just a few days ago on a 5-layered aluminum kind of, it looks like a Reynolds wrap that you put over the insulation in your attic, and it's supposed to keep the heat in and keep the heat out in the summer. Have you ever heard about that?
A reflective insulation, yes. There's a lot of uses for reflective insulation, depending on how much insulation you've got in your attic, how much ventilation you've got, how much air loss through the house.
Mm-hmm.
Everything all depends. Originally, Tyvek, which we are right now using for wrapping houses, was developed and engineered for doing almost the same thing, laying over the top of the insulation in the attic to reduce airflow through it. So there are some gains for the foil-faced reflective-type insulations, but I'm not sure that they are a cure-all. If you've got very little insulation in the attic, then it's going to help, but I don't know that it's going to help necessarily any more than adding another 4 to 6 inches of loose-fill fiberglass or a blown-in-type fiberglass insulation.
Mm-hmm. So would you recommend it then? What about the lightning? It is a metal. Would a lightning affect it?
Well, it's not going to attract lightning. It's protected with the inside the attic. It's not necessarily grounded. It's not connected to ground. The foil is kind of a conductive, but it's almost a mylar or a plastic foil, and any heat source would effectively melt it almost instantly rather than transfer any electrical energy. So I wouldn't worry about the lightning aspect.
Now, would you recommend it, though? It isn't cheap. It's over $2,000, but to lay it in the attic, about $2,000.
See, that's where I run into an issue. Yes, it's going to save some energy by creating this reflective insulation,
yes.
But from a cost standpoint, I don't know that you're ever going to recoup your cost. How much insulation do you have in the attic currently?
Well, I think it's a thick one. I never measured it, but it's a thick one. Like what is that? 2-3 inches or 4?
Okay. Well, the standard.
Wait, it goes up to the top. It goes from the floor to the up to the rafters.
Okay.
Yeah. I never measured it.
Well, if it's an older house, you could have a 3.5-inch bat. If it's one of the newer houses, we get an R19 or a 6-inch bat. Or if we get into the,
I probably don't have that much. Mine is a 50-year-old house. However, we did have it insulated, I don't know if it's 30 years ago. Probably would still be a little thinner, wouldn't it?
If the insulation was put in that long ago, yeah, it's probably a 3.5-inch bat. My guess is for about $400 to $500, you could add another 8 to 10 inches of loose fill fiberglass insulation and save about the same energy savings you could with the reflective foil. The reflective foil works well in areas where we are very confined, where we don't have room to put that much insulation.
Mm-hmm.
But most attic areas are wide open spaces, so we don't necessarily need to have the high-tech insulation.
Okay, tell me again, is this loose? You're saying this is a loose insulation, it's not in bats that you're recommending?
What I like to recommend is a fiberglass bat for a base, which is what you most likely have in the house.
I think that's what I have, uh-huh.
And then a loose fill over the top of it. Bat insulation works quite well, but it is difficult to fit around a lot of items such as cross members, joists, ceiling fans, electrical boxes, wiring, etc.
Uh-huh.
And by having the bat in there where it doesn't move around, the wind doesn't move it, and then putting loose fill over the top of it, we fill in all the gaps around all the edges and all the openings and things like that. So the loose fill insulation, not only does it add to your insulating value, but it also increases the performance of the bat insulation that's already installed.
Oh, that sounds very, very good. Okay, how much, let's see, if I have 3.5, which I have to check, and then I should have how much of the loose fill? Did you say again?
I would say a minimum of about 6 to 8 inches.
6 to 8 inches.
As energy prices go up, we can make a case for going 8 to 10 inches. Since it is a loose fill, it doesn't go in a completely uniform.
You know it's going up.
Yeah, a lot depends. You want to be able to put in as much as possible without blocking any of your ventilation. They may have to install some air chutes or something, go out to the soffit areas. But yeah, 8 inches of insulation, either 8 to 10 or 6 to 8, depending on how much you've got there now, should make a noticeable difference.
Okay, then don't worry about the aluminum.
Like I say, the aluminum reflective stuff does work, but from a cost standpoint, unless you've got a real constricted space where we can't put in 10 inches insulation, I don't know that the extra cost is going to recoup.
I have no floor, and it's just the beams, you know, across.
Mm-hmm.
No floor, and nothing's up there except a little bit of stuff.
I think for the energy savings and the initial cost, you're probably better off with the loose fill.
Okay. Well, listen, I'm so glad I talked to you. You have a good, happy new year.
All right. Well, thanks very much.
Happy holidays, you too.
We'll continue here. The next person in line is in Urbana. That would be line number 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
My question has to do with the best way to fix my mother's furnace. I'm going to be visiting her, and she's got a problem with a water feed to her furnace that closes off within about a year of being installed because of mineral deposits.
Okay. I assume that we're talking a boiler, or are we talking a humidifier here?
It's a boiler system that goes, you know, she's got water, old-fashioned water radiators,
mm-hmm.
water circulating radiators.
Well, an old boiler system does have some loss of water, so there is usually a pressure valve which will maintain a minimum pressure.
She had this furnace replaced just 3 years ago, and within a year, the mineral deposits made it impossible for her to leave home for more than a week because she has to go down and add water to the furnace.
It sounds like a fill valve problem.
Yeah, and it just shuts off because of the mineral deposits.
Well, they make some filters that can be put into the line in front of it to try and filter out the mineral deposits before they get to the fill valve.
Oh, yeah?
She must live in an area that does not have the same quality water that we enjoy here in Champaign-Urbana.
No, we're lucky.
We have some quite good water here. Usually mineral deposits are corrected with water softeners and things like that, but there are also some filters that can be put in. But for a valve to, first of all, to move enough water to lime up or to get a mineral deposit within 3 years, sounds to me like we may have a system that's using water, or we're not completely sealed, so we're losing more water than what we should. I'm afraid I'm going to have to defer this to a service person because that's an individual case that I don't think I can fix with a blanket answer.
Mm-hmm.
So I would get somebody who is very versed in boiler systems to come out and take a look at it and see if they can't recommend something, because there's no way that valve should have limed up in that amount of time. In order for mineral deposits to occur, we have to get evaporation. The mineral would rather stay dissolved into the water system. And the only time that the minerals come out is when the water evaporates. And why we're getting evaporation around the valve, or we're getting enough movement through the valve to filter out the minerals. The heating system should be a closed system, or we're not running that much water. Occasionally you need to add just a little bit, but it should not add enough to block the valve.
Interesting. Okay, well, that gives me at least a point of question. Do you think I could go after 3 years back to the guy that did the installation and say, what the heck is going on here?
Well, he'd be a good place to start.
Thanks for your help.
All right, thank you.
Bye. And again, to the next caller, and this would be in Urbana, and line number 2. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. With regard to the compact fluorescents, I'm sure that I found one that can be used with a dimmer. You have to look really, really, really carefully. The other thing that I've learned from poking around on the internet recently is that the electronic ballast in both the long tube fluorescents and the compacts use a different way of getting the phosphor glowing. And instead of having a heating element in the ballast the way the magnetic ballasts do, they put a lot of current across the pins to get it to glow. And if you turn a light on and off a lot, that you end up burning out the starter mechanism in the electronic ballast earlier. So it's an interesting question to try and answer for oneself. I was looking at this because we have an entryway there where we come in at the far end of the house off the garage. We call it our mudroom. And our hands are often full, and we would often forget to go down and turn the fluorescent light off down there in my laundry room. And sometimes it would be on all night. So what I put in was a motion-sensing switch that can pick up motion within a 180-degree span. But it requires a magnetic ballast. And as it happened, that fluorescent light also needed the ballast, had just died. So instead of putting an electronic ballast in, I went to the electrical supply store and I got an old-fashioned magnetic ballast, because I figured having it on just for 15 minutes when we come through there and turns itself off now, was better than leaving it on all night. But the electronic ballast use less power. They don't actually sit there and heat up the bulb the way the magnetic ones do. So it's worth poking around. And thank heavens for the internet. If people have problems, I would suggest looking on the internet, because I was just amazed at this switch. It's made by Leviton, and I wired it. It's for a three-pole situation. In other words, I had two switches controlling this light.
A three-way, yeah.
Three-way. And I wired it the way it seemed to suggest, though it only gave one situation, there are about three different ways that these switches can be wired depending on where the power comes in. And I couldn't get it to work, so I went and looked online, and I found other people had the same problem, and it turns out the company has mislabeled the wires, which I found helpful to find out. Somebody else had actually gone to and received a diagram from a technician at Leviton, and it turned out it was still miswired, but it gave me a clue. So if you have problems with things, it's the Internet now does give some...
There can be some very good information on there. There's some misleading information, too. It's like television was years back. It's a great source of information, but you have to take it with a grain of salt.
Yeah, but sometimes what you can do, in my case, what I did was I entered the name of the company and the model number of the item, and I found several websites talking about problems that people had with it. So using Google... Sometimes you can find answers to really odd questions, so I'm just suggesting that. The other thing I would like you to answer sometime is I've heard about, and I know that there are some houses, high energy efficiency houses in around Champaign-Urbana now that have air exhausts that have heat exchangers. So in bringing in refreshing air from the outside and sending out bad air, stale air, ventilating, moist air, whatever, it extracts the heat and leaves the heat inside.
Yeah.
So what I'm wondering is, where do you find these things, and can you retrofit, can you use them in a house that's already built? So I think from an answer you gave maybe last time, that wasn't one of your specialties, and if it isn't, I'm wondering if you could do some research and tell us about them.
Well, I have seen the air-to-air exchange units, and they are good for taking the air in the house, basically sending it back outside, but the outside air you're bringing in, you transfer the heat to it so you don't have as much heat loss. I have not done enough research to be able to tell you whether or not in this climate with our temperature differences, whether or not it's actually cost effective. A lot of people feel we need to have a lot more air moving through the house. We're trying to make our building materials so that we have less and less chemicals coming out of it, so we need less and less air exchange. It's kind of an ongoing thing. I have seen them, and they were actually very popular at the builder trade shows, I want to say about 7 or 8 years ago, but they've never really materialized and shown up in the general population, so I haven't come across them enough to get any real-world information on them.
Because when we ventilate our bathrooms, you know, moisture there and places like that, I would think this would be a good application for them. Well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We have about 10 minutes left, actually maybe more like 7-8 minutes, in this part of Focus 580 with Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's on the program once a month, always on a Monday, to answer questions about home maintenance. 333-9455 is the number for Champaign-Urbana. If you have a question, toll-free 800-222-9455. Back again to caller here. Next in line is in Champaign, in line 1. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Mm-hmm. I have comments for two of the previous callers. One is that those houses that the caller directly before me was talking about are built by Ecolab, and there is something in the phone book that says, like a longer thing of that. I closed the book now. It's Economical or Ecological Construction Laboratory, and I think that's them. And they built the last two houses. I think they're still building one on Fairview in Urbana, and the one next door to it is finished. So they have used that in their houses, and it seems to work really well. But, of course, that's new construction, so I don't know about retrofitting. But the architect is Katrin Klinkenberg, I believe. So if somebody wanted to research that. And then the about the compact fluorescence, I just happen to have a Consumer Reports from October at hand, and it has an article on the compact fluorescence. And on page 9, it's a little sidebar called "The Bulb is in the Mail." It says Sylvania has a box that sells for $15. Called Recycle Pack, and it can hold 12 small or 8 medium to large CFLs. And there's a shipping label, prepaid shipping label in it, and you can send the bulbs back and they will recycle them and reuse the mercury. It's kind of expensive, but Consumer Reports estimates you still save even doing that. And then their article starts on page 28 about CFLs. And it does say there are even CFLs that can be used with three-way switches and dimmers. And I do have a yellow bug light that's one of the spiral ones that I've got in a covered but not enclosed fixture on my back porch, which is the porch itself is covered with translucent fiberglass panels, and it's closed in with screens, and I haven't had any problems with that.
Yeah, it shouldn't be a problem unless, though I believe our other caller was referring to fixtures which are almost airtight, not completely, but don't have a lot of ventilation through there. And most fixtures do have enough air ventilation that I wouldn't worry about using the compact fluorescents in them.
Well, you can't seem to use them, most of them, directly outside, you know, where there's no protection. But in that sort of halfway state that my back porch is, it seems to work really well. And if it's a bug light, of course, it's designed to be outside.
Right. So. My guess is it probably isn't going to work in extremely cold weather. A lot of the fluorescents don't come up in brightness till they warm up.
Yeah, it worked all last winter.
Okay, great.
But again, that's in a somewhat protected situation. But they also say in the article that the CFLs that they tested contained about 5 milligrams or less of mercury, which is about 1% of the amount in an old-fashioned thermometer. So it is a very, very small amount, but it is there.
It is there, yes.
So
I'm sure we'll be hearing more about it for too long. The media will get a hold of it, and we'll have a big front-page article on on the amount of mercury we're putting back out there.
Yeah, and then CFL@EnergyStar.com has information, too. That's a website.
All right. Well, thank you for the extra advice.
You're welcome.
All right. We got at least one more here. Let's go to Champaign County, line number 3. Hello.
Hi. Eco-Lab, for people that want to look at their website. Somebody else had Ecolabs. But LEDs are an important thing to think of too. They last longer. I don't think they have the disposal problem. I think they work with most TRIAC-based dimmers just out of the box. You don't have to worry about what your starter is, and you're seeing more of them. They are pretty expensive, but they last so very long that they're
Last quite a long time, and they are very high energy savings type devices, and they are becoming more and more popular. And as the price comes down, they'll become more attractive for more things, I'm sure.
Right, right. I actually wanted, and there's only a moment left. I've been trying to get on for a while, but I'm sure I can find some of this stuff. But as membrane roofing material is being more coming down to a handyman kind of thing, I'm wondering whether there are any tips in the last few minutes or someplace to point to about how to find out information about using. I know it's used for ice dams, and we don't usually have any trouble with that, but I guess last year was the first year in a while we had a lot of ice damming, and so just something on that in the last few minutes, if you could. Thanks.
Okay.
Well, there's definitely ice damming anytime we have a freeze-thaw type of situation, particularly we get a lot of snow and it stays around for a long period of time, and the warmth from your attic goes up there and tends to melt the bottom layer, and it runs down the roof and it gets out to the overhang and refreezes. So a lot depends on how much overhang you have, how much slope you've got on the overhang, how long we have the cold weather, how much snow is on top of it, how much heat loss we have through the attic. So ice damming, I run into it on a yearly basis. There are some years where we have more problems with it than others just due to how much snow we get before a temperature change. And the membrane roofing, usually you get them either a rubber type roofing or you can get a tar type membrane with an adhesive back, and they are very good. They make one that's actually what a snow and ice shield or ice and water shield. And in low pitched areas or in areas of tight concentrations of angles, a lot of dormers and valley junctures and stuff, it's not a bad idea to install that stuff. is kind of an underlayment for extra protection. So in case we do get some snow or ice damming up, that the water doesn't back up under the shingles and get directly to the roof sheathing. So, and they are available at most of the local do-it-yourself places, and the self-adhesive ones are pretty self-explanatory. You just want to make sure that water always ends up to the top side, so you start at the bottom and work your way up.
Okay. One more call here. Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Quick question about these portable heaters. The one I'm looking at now is a full-page ad on Eden Pure. I don't know if you can comment on any particular one, but are they effective?
Most portable heaters are effective for a very small area, if that's what you're trying to do. Most of the time, the American public right now doesn't want to heat a small area. They want the entire house to be within 2 degrees from room to room, top to bottom. Whereas 80 years ago, the potbelly stove in the middle of the room, you adjusted the temperature by how far back you sat from it.
So that's where you save the money then, huh?
Yeah, basically what it is, but a lot of the energy savings you get is if you're going to be in one area for an extended period of time, you can put that in there and heat that one area. But you're still, the rest of the house is then going to feel cold. So if that's something that does not bother you, then yes, you can use those for that space or spot heating. Electrical heat on something like that is still, I mean, it's 100% efficient in that all the heat produced by the power is transferred into the room. But generally speaking, electrical heat is still just a little bit more expensive than gas heat. Of course, as our gas prices go up, we may have to change that train of thought.
Yeah, of course, electricity will go up too.
More than likely, since a lot of it is fueled by the same gas that we're using to create our heat from our furnaces.
Yeah, I think I have a couple other questions about it, but I think we're about out of time.
Yeah, I'm afraid so. We're going to have to, I appreciate you calling and everybody else who called, but we're going to have to wrap it up because we've come to the end of the time. Scott, I will be back, I expect, next month, and we'll do it again then.
Yes, we will.
Thank you very much. Scott Spies, he's a home inspector with the Spies Home Inspection Service, and he's on the program once a month, always on a Monday, for these shows we do on home care and maintenance.